Welcome to Summit Church. Here, we strive to be a church where you can belong long before you come to believe. At each of our locations, we worship together, learn and grow together, serve together, and form relationships around a common purpose, to inspire people to find and follow the way of Jesus. Join us in listening to this week's sermon. Good morning, Summit. Welcome into this space today. Thank you for bringing the church into these walls. Thank you for choosing to spend your Sunday here. It's a pleasure to get to be with you. As Caroline said, my name is Katie. I serve here at Summit Orlando on our adults ministry team, and it is a pleasure to get to share with you today. As she said, also, we are continuing in our series, Conversations with Jesus. But before we get into our conversation today, I am wondering if you could help me with a little poll. You may have noticed in the past couple of years that people have become, I think, more and more obsessed, I might say, with water bottles, water cups, truly water vessels of any kind. And I'm wondering where we all kind of fall on our preferences of how we like to carry around our water. We already have one being offered up to the Lord today. That's good. So who in the room are my Stanley fans? We get we got some over here. We got some. Okay. We have some Stanley people. Who is a Hydro Flask user? Who stands by their Hydro Flask? We've got some. Okay. I'm not lying to you. I'm actually seeing hands. This isn't one of those fake and there's one. Any OG Nalgene and Camelback users that are still rocking a plastic bottle? Okay. Love that for you. But I mean, you can drop that off a building, run it over with a car. It'll be fine. So that's good. Anyone who is right now thinking, I don't know, I use a water bottle. I'm not paying attention to this. Yes, okay, mm-hmm, yeah. And any Awala fans? That was what was previously offered up to the Lord. Awala is a popular choice right now. Personally, I like to have a combo deal. So I have an Awala because it's both a bottle and a straw. And it's magical in that way. But it does tend to grow mold, so I don't have it with me today because I need to wash it. But in general, I stand by my Awala as my out and about bottle. But then at home, I have a Hydro Flask cup that I use there. Didn't know that was an option, did you? But there's a cup version and it's got a straw too. Because I just simply cannot be bothered to unscrew a thing to drink my water. I won't do it. I will be dehydrated all of the time. So I have to have a straw. But now the real question is, who out here is sitting here and then good-naturedly in this conversation, but you're living out here just not carrying water around? You're just free-birding it. Okay, there's so many of you. There are so many of you. This is terrifying. Okay, so you're just driving around, riding a little Vespa around town, and you're just not having any water? You just hope that there will be water if you need it? What do you do? What do you do if you get thirsty? Do you just, you wait? You wait until you get home? A water fountain? Okay, but I used to work with our students, right? And it's not just you guys, everybody does this. But sometimes people put their mouths on water fountains, And I don't like that. That gives me the ick. So I can't fathom how you guys live your lives, honestly. If I leave my bottle at work, then I have to bring my home cup in the car for my 20-minute commute. Because what if I need water in those 20 minutes? What am I gonna do? I get a little panicky if I don't have water and some tissues around on me at all times. But maybe that's a personal problem. I don't know, it's possible. But I think there is something about being thirsty that drives us to carry around some very large water bottles. Something about being thirsty that will drive us to water. And so today, the conversation that we will enter into revolves around water and a transformational promise that if we drink the water that Jesus gives, we will never thirst again. Let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll get into our conversation. Father, you are the water that never will run dry. Blessed are you, our sovereign and good God. In the midst of discord, in the midst of disaster or tragedy, you reign. In times when evil is evident, and also in times when blessing abounds, you reign. We come before you today asking for comfort, God, and provision. Some of us come into this place today burdened for those who have lost loved ones, homes, and livelihoods in the flooding in Texas and Mexico. Some of us this morning are anxious and burdened by what we see in the news or perhaps by the news that we've personally received. And some of us are coming, God, joyfully celebrating. And so, Father, we ask that however we come, that you would meet us here in a fresh way. Would you grant us wisdom on our next steps? Would you comfort those who are grieving and lift up the burdened? Move in us, God, convicting us where we need to be convicted, comforting us where we need, and spurring us to action where we need by your Spirit. Reveal to us your thoughts as we approach your word, that we may be might understand them. Give to us your wisdom that we might know your ways and follow them, and enlighten, God, our desires that we might seek you more fully. And may my words be clear and honorable in your sight. Amen. Our conversation today comes from John chapter 4. And the Gospel of John includes a lot of these like one-on-one conversations between Jesus and other people. And the overall plot of that book uses these conversations to push the reader towards a response to Jesus. In the characters that we meet, we see an array of possible ways someone could respond to Jesus. And as we engage those stories, we are then tasked to begin searching for our own response to him. And in today's conversation, we'll not only see an individual's transformational response, but how her response ushered in a transformation for her entire village and potentially even an entire ethnic group. We'll see that Jesus works in unexpected circumstances through unexpected people to reveal himself in unexpected ways. And so as we turn to John 4, I'll tell you that this conversation is rather long. It's actually the longest recorded conversation that Jesus has with anyone in the Bible. And that's going to be increasingly more surprising as we find out more about who it is that he's talking with. And so in the previous chapter, John is writing that Jesus has been in a place called Judea, where he was garnering a lot of unwanted attention from religious leaders. And so he has left Judea and is heading 70 miles north to Galilee. And we'll pick that up in John chapter 4, verse 3. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. And now he had to go through Samaria, and so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. It says that Jesus had to go through Samaria, but why? The simplest explanation of why he had to go through Samaria is because it was on the way. Imagine that you're headed to Tampa. Most likely you're gonna go through Lakeland to get there. Samaria was just on the way from Judea to Galilee. But why does the author need to tell us that he had to go through Samaria? It's because the Jewish people and the Samaritans did not get along, to say the least. The Jewish people looked down on the Samaritans and would avoid them at all costs. Eating or drinking with a Samaritan person was even enough to make you considered ritually or religiously unclean. And so normally, if a Jewish person was going from Judea up to Galilee, they would go out of their way to go around Samaria. It'd be like rerouting around Lakeland on your way to Tampa. It's doable, but like if you're walking, that's really rather inconvenient and it's gonna stretch your journey out a lot longer. But Jesus doesn't go around Samaria as we would expect. He chooses to go through it. And not only does it say he went through it, but that he had to go through Samaria. And so soon we'll see why. We'll pick up in verse 6. Jacob's well was there in Sychar, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. So Jesus is tired, and he sits down at this well to take a little rest, but he doesn't have anything to draw water with. And to our ears, that makes a lot of sense. He's one of you guys out here that doesn't carry a water bottle. And so he has become thirsty on his long journey and he sat down to take a drink. But to a Jewish audience, this intro to him would sound a little bit different. Imagine it like this. If I were gonna tell you the plot of a movie and I started to describe it and I said, well, it starts with a woman living in a big city with a fancy job and a fancy boyfriend. But for some unexpected reason, she has to travel to a quaint little town. And there she meets a handsome baker who is also a carpenter who also has an alpaca farm. I think you know where this is going. I think we all know that this is the copy-paste formula of a Hallmark movie that has done very well and has a very specific market. But it's this formula, right? Give us the first 2 minutes and we can generally fill in the rest of what's gonna happen in the story. She's going to fall madly in love with both the man and the town. And then there's going to be some kind of misunderstanding or crisis around the 75% mark, but they're going to figure it out. It's going to be okay. They're going to save the town. They'll live happily ever after. And then the last 30 seconds or so of the movie will include a cute little kiss, safe for the whole family. Well, Jesus sitting down at a well in a foreign land, that's the first 2 minutes of a Hallmark movie to the Jewish people. Back in the very beginnings of Israel's history, we see over and over again that these particular encounters at a well keep happening. And that formula goes something like this. Boy finds a well in a foreign land. A girl appears, and he asks her for a drink. And she gives him a drink, and he declares, I'm going to marry you, if that's cool with you. He doesn't always ask. And then she runs home to get her father and bring him back to meet the boy, and then they get married. We see this with Jacob and Rebecca, with Isaac and Rachel, with Moses and Zipporah, all of three of whom are like the founding fathers of the Jewish faith. There was quite literally something in the water in those wells that you had to meet your spouse at a well. Couldn't tell you why. We don't really have wells anymore, so I'm not sure what the current equivalent of that is. Maybe a small quaint town, apparently, with an alpaca farm. So when we see Jesus, a boy in a foreign land, sitting down at a well, a woman coming to the well, and Jesus asks her for a drink, the author is painting our expectations of what's going to happen next. But then the woman unexpectedly breaks that formula, and instead of joyfully giving Jesus a drink, she questions him. She draws attention to the peculiarity of their situation, and she says to him, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? And we have every reason to believe that her question is a very honest one. Not only was it considered inappropriate for Jesus, a Jewish man, to be engaging with a Samaritan at all, it was especially taboo in that culture for Jesus, a man, to be speaking to a woman alone in general. The disciples had left to go into the town, so we know that there was nobody else at the well. In Jewish religious texts of this time, there are all sorts of instructions for rabbis or religious teachers about their interactions with women. And one of them says, no one should hold a conversation with a woman on the street, not even his own wife, and certainly not any other woman, because people will talk. Not much has changed these days. People do still talk. But Jesus was often called a rabbi by his followers. He would have been expected to uphold these kinds of instructions. But here Jesus is, choosing to go through Samaria, choosing to speak alone with this woman, and everything about this interaction is unexpected. We're meant to be thrown off by it because Jesus doesn't work by our logic or our sense of reasoning or according to our expectations. Again, he doesn't work by our logic or our reasoning or according to our expectations. Jesus will show up when and where we would least expect him to reveal himself to those we'd least expect him to, and do it in ways that we would never predict. In Isaiah 55, God says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. When we box Jesus into our ideas of how he should operate, we can miss what he's actually doing. If we had been holding up to the religious norms of the day, we would have advised Jesus to go around Samaria to avoid the woman at the well, and we would have done so thinking that it made good sense, that it was the most strategic move, that we were offering him wisdom. But then everything that is to come in our story up next would not have happened. So I wonder for us, where have we boxed Jesus in with the walls of our expectations? What have you missed or seeing or experiencing because it just didn't seem to make sense? And are you willing to be surprised by Jesus, to meet him in the unexpected and see what story he might be telling that's better than the one you're telling yourself? It can be scary to accept something that we don't entirely understand or that we can't make sense of. It can be scary to move forward when we're not sure where the path will take us. But it can be worth it because his thoughts are not our thoughts. And his ways are not our ways. Jesus had to go through Samaria and ask the Samaritan woman for a drink because he had a plan that even his own disciples would never have predicted. And the woman asks him, how can you ask me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? Let's see how Jesus responds in verse 10. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it was that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. In this exchange, Jesus sets her up for two follow-up questions. First, what is the gift of living water? What is the gift of God? And second, who is the man that is asking her for a drink? At this point, if I was her, I think most of us, if we were her, we'd employ the smile and nod, oh, that's so nice, thanks so much, I'm gonna get my water and go away now. And I would get out of there, because I don't know what's happening. When I go to the water fountain, I am not looking for this kind of philosophical interaction. But she stays. She stays in the conversation, even though she's not quite picking up on what Jesus is laying down. And we'll see that continue throughout this conversation. The woman doesn't fully understand, but as they talk, she progressively begins to understand more and more who it is that she's speaking to. And Jesus here has moved on to metaphorical water. He's really not talking about the well in front of them anymore, but her mind is still on that physical water. So she first asks a very natural question. How are you going to draw the water? Jesus didn't bring his Stanley bucket with him, so how is he supposed to get water out of that well that he's promising to give her? And after Jesus promises that those who drink water, the water that he offers, will never thirst again, she's still thinking about literal water. But she is in on what she understands. She says, sir, give me this water. She doesn't really understand what he's offering, but to the extent that she does understand, she wants what he has to give her. She stays in the conversation, and that's something I think that maybe we don't do enough. Be it in conversations that we have amongst ourselves or conversations with God, we don't stay. Once the conversation goes in a direction we didn't expect or that we don't like or to a place that we're maybe not wanting to go, or maybe we simply don't understand the conversation very well, we bail. We withdraw. We tune out. We smile and nod, or maybe we scowl and sigh, and we walk away. And when we walk away from the conversation with Jesus because we don't like what we hear, or because the questions that we have don't seem to be answered, or because it gets a little vulnerable, we miss an opportunity. We miss the opportunity to learn and to grow and to be transformed by an encounter with Christ. And we miss an opportunity to invite others into that transformation alongside of us. But what can it look like for us to stay in the conversation? Would that look like continuing to show up here even if you're not sure about it all yet? Would it look like continuing to ask questions even if you're worried about the answers you might get? Is it choosing to be honest and vulnerable even if you're worried about being rejected? Is it continuing to engage with Scripture even when it doesn't always make a whole lot of sense? Is it choosing to trust that God sees the bigger picture even if you don't or you can't? Stay in the conversation and ask Jesus to give you this living water, even if you don't really understand what it even is yet. If we thought we would have walked away after maybe the last bit of that conversation, getting a little too deep at the water fountain, then I think we definitely would walk away after this next bit. After the woman asks for this water, Jesus offers, he responds in verse 16 saying, he told her, go and call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had 5 husbands, and the man you have now is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. So Jesus now just abandons the water topic entirely, just leaves it right in the dust, and tells her to go and call her husband. And I can almost hear her heart drop when he tells her to go and call her husband, because she has no husband, as he tells us, or she tells us. So was Jesus going to be done speaking with her without her having a man to accompany her? Was this living water only available to her if her husband was beside her? I imagine that that's what she expects. That's what she thinks maybe. That's why Jesus is asking for her to go call her husband. But as it turns out, Jesus knows far more of her story than she thought. He knows that she, in fact, has had 5 husbands. Now, we can make all sorts of assumptions about how she came to have 5 husbands based on this information, but the truth is that we don't know. We don't know all the circumstances around how she ended up here, but what we do know is that at the time, women were not able to divorce their husbands. So if she had had 5 husbands, either they divorced her or they had died. And we also know that there were various reasons under Roman law that she could have ended up living with someone who was not her husband that wouldn't necessarily have been like a huge deal, because for some reason they couldn't legally marry under Roman law. We know that Jesus does not condemn her. He doesn't call her to go and repent. His wounds don't carry a tone of chastisement. His focus right here isn't on her past. It isn't on what might be a shaming to her. It isn't on any sin of hers. Rather, he reveals something about her story in order to reveal something about himself to her. He shines a light on something that she probably did carry some kind of shame about in order to shed light on his own identity. He's still getting her to ask the question from verse 10, who is it that's asking me for a drink? And it's often through revealing something to us about our own stories or about ourselves that Jesus reveals something about himself. When we recognize that we are sick, he might reveal that he is healer. When we recognize that we are not in control, he might reveal himself as sovereign. When we recognize that we fall short or that we're not enough, he reveals himself as giving grace sufficient for our needs. When we recognize that we are grieving, he reveals himself as comforter. When we recognize that we have emotional pain, he reveals himself as our empathetic high priest. When we recognize our need for connection and provision, he reveals himself as the bridegroom. When we recognize our thirst, he reveals himself as the giver of living water. So maybe like the woman, you've stayed in the conversation with Jesus, but you have come to a place that you are longing for him to reveal himself. Ask him. Ask him to reveal himself to you. It could certainly be through like a new understanding, a vision, a dream, a miracle that you could come to understand him. But it doesn't need to be that way. Jesus can use what we already know about our own stories and our own lives to reveal himself to us in a deeper way. We, like the Samaritan woman, must only ask for what he's offered and then be open to receiving it. After Jesus reveals what he knows about the woman, she takes another step toward understanding. She calls him a prophet. She's amazed at what he has told her and how he could possibly know this thing about her. He's like some random Jewish man she's run into at a well, and he knows all these secrets about her. And once again, I think this is where I bow out of the conversation. Like the random person at the gas station telling me secrets about my life, I'm out. I don't want that. I don't want any part of this. But she stays. I'm not recommending we stay at the gas station, but she stays and she leans in because she now believes him to be a prophet. And she asks him to shed light on like the biggest tension point between Jews and Samaritans. And it's this question of where are they supposed to worship? This is what they would fight over all the time. And so she asks in verse 19, "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshiped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers that the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I am the one speaking to you. I am he." Jesus' answer here could be probably a whole sermon or multiple in of itself, but I think we all like to eat lunch at some point today, so I'm just gonna say this. His response is one that breaks down barriers. He no longer defines worshipers as Jewish worshipers and Samaritan worshipers, but he's speaking of a day when there will be a third kind, true worshipers. Yes, salvation is from the Jews because, as we have identified, Jesus is a Jew. Salvation is from the Jews, but it is not only for the Jews. As we'll see later, it's actually for the whole world. And the woman still doesn't like fully understand what it is Jesus is saying, but she's hopeful. She doesn't understand everything he means, but she believes that one day a Messiah will come and will explain all of the complicated things that Jesus is saying. And at this point, she's not calling him the Messiah. She's not calling him that person. She's just sharing her hope for that Messiah. But Jesus surprises her by saying, "Actually, I'm him. I'm the Messiah that you hope for." In her own words, "I am the one who will come and explain everything to you." And this is the first time that we see Jesus identify himself this way, as the Messiah, the Christ, the one who is promised. And it's incredibly unexpected. He doesn't first declare himself to his family or to his followers or to any religious leaders or important person of any kind, he chooses to declare himself to a woman, a Samaritan woman, a Samaritan woman with a sketchy history, and a Samaritan woman with a sketchy history who doesn't actually really understand what he's saying. In that day and age, it doesn't get a whole lot lower in the social circle than her. She has no power to speak of, but it is to her that Jesus chooses to reveal himself for the first time. If you have any notion or thought that maybe Jesus won't reveal himself to you or wouldn't engage you in conversation because of who you are or what you've done or what you do and don't know or understand, look no further than the Samaritan woman with a sketchy past who doesn't get it. This is who he chooses as the first person to receive the truth of who he is. There is nothing that will stop Jesus from revealing himself to you. You just have to ask and be willing to be surprised. The question verse 10 asked, "Who is it that's asking me for a drink?" is answered. It's the Messiah, the Son of God. And the question left then is, what is this woman going to do in response to that news? So we'll pick up in verse 27. "Just then, his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking to a woman. But no one asked, 'What do you want?' or 'Why are you talking with her?' Then, leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, 'Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?' They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. 'He told me everything I ever did.' And so when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them. And he stayed 2 days, and because of his words, many more came to believe. And they said to the woman, 'We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world.'" When the disciples suddenly arrive back, they're surprised to see Jesus speaking with a woman, but they are smart enough not to say anything about it. We can probably learn something from them. I think by the end of John's gospel, this won't be surprising to them anymore because Jesus is going to do this a whole bunch more times. But this is the first time they've encountered this. So they're kind of surprised, but they're going to be slow about it. And those of us who have been here for the whole conversation, we may have forgotten how odd it would have been for Jesus to be speaking with this woman. So the author is reminding us, this is very unexpected. Jesus is acting in a very unexpected way. And the woman, in her excitement, leaves her water jar behind and heads back into town and invites them, the whole town, to come and see. And now that's not the first time that we hear that invitation, come and see, in John's gospel. We first heard it back in chapter 1. Jesus invites two guys that are following him to come and see where he's staying, to come and see him. And then one of those guys, Philip, tells another guy named Nathaniel to come and see Jesus. And next week, Chris is going to unpack that entire conversation between Philip and Nathaniel and Jesus for us. And he's going to unpack a little bit even more what this invitation of come and see looks like. And so you want to make sure you come back next week for that conversation. But for now, we don't have a religious Jewish man like they were, but rather a Samaritan woman going and saying to the men in her village, come and see, could this be the Messiah? She offers up a still unsure question. Could this be? And perhaps she's not sure yet, but she knows that there's something about him, something that she needs to share with other people. Even before really understanding it at all, she knew she had to share it. She brought others to Jesus simply by telling them what he had done, who she thought he was. And in the end, it was because of Jesus' words, not hers, that they believed. All she had to do was invite them and bring them to Jesus, and he did the rest. Staying in the conversation with Jesus, coming into contact with who he is, ought to lead us to others, inviting them to come and see as we have. But we don't need to wait to invite people until we have all the answers. If that was the case, none of us could ever say come and see, because we'll never have all the answers. Our role, like the Samaritan woman, is to tell others about our encounter with Jesus and simply invite them to come and to see him and to encounter him for themselves. We are not able to make people believe in Jesus. Our role is simply to invite them in, bring them to Jesus, and let him do the rest. She told them, come and see the one who told me everything I've ever done. I wonder how you would finish that sentence. Come and see Jesus, the one who, fill in the blank. What can you share with someone about the encounters that you've had with Jesus? And for those who are here who might say, I don't really have anything to put in the blank. I'm not really sure that I've ever encountered Jesus, or I don't know that I've started the conversation with him yet. Then this invitation is for you too. Come and see. You don't need answers or qualifications. You don't need to fit into some mold. You don't need to clean yourself up first. You just take the next step and come and see. Maybe that looks like coming back next week to hear Chris's message. Maybe that's setting up a meeting with a pastor. Maybe that's coming down for prayer after the service. Maybe it's asking the questions that you've been holding on to, or starting to read and engage with the Bible, or beginning a practice of prayer yourself, starting that conversation with Jesus at home. Wherever you are, I invite you, come and see who Jesus is. Each conversation that Jesus has with a character in the book of John is driving the plot forward. As they learn who Jesus is, they respond to that revelation, and we are in turn invited to respond to the revelation of Jesus as well. The Samaritan woman stayed in the conversation with him, even when it didn't make a whole lot of sense. And before she ever understood what he was offering, she became aware of her own thirst and her own need, and she asked for living water. Jesus revealed himself to her using her own story to do it. And her response was to run back to her village and bring all of them with her. She went back to a place that she probably didn't have a lot of status or clout, and she invited them all to come and see. So what will your response be today? Will you admit that your sense of logic or reason might not be the same as God's, that he acts in unexpected ways? Will you stay in the conversation with Jesus? Will you ask Jesus to reveal himself to you and be open to him using your story to do it? Will you go out and invite somebody else to come in and see? I'll close with this. John the Apostle, who authored the book, the Gospel of John, he also wrote the book of Revelation, which is the last book in the Bible. And almost the last words he writes in that very last book echo this story, this promise of living water and never thirsting again. Revelation 22:17 says, "The Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life."
Thank you so much for listening with us today. Remember, you can also watch our services on YouTube or at summitchurchfl.org. Those links can be found in the show notes, along with ways to follow us on social media. Now, go in God's grace and peace. We look forward to worshiping with you soon.